London calling. This is London calling on Longwave. London calling. This is Westminster.
I am not an American. I am a free man.
Calm down. I'm okay. With a combat unit, it's armed with automatic weapons.
Come on, Mrs. Jones. You've got to go to your second job now. You've got to earn extra money to pay the bedroom tax.
I'm very lucky. I've got a second job in a chemical plant. Yeah, I'm making fluoride for Syria. They're shipping it to Syria.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to join Chris Everard in an undisclosed location deep under Buckingham Palace in Winston Churchill's war bunker.
Let's never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories.
God damn it, boy! These Brits are coming to get us!
Welcome, my friends, to the Silver Neverland.
My husband and I are not amused.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
Deep from inside the former communist bloc, where we now torture American citizens in Poland and the Balkan states, we're tuning in to the Chris Everard Show.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Chris Everard, and we are broadcasting live on the Truth Frequency. Welcome back. This is Chris Everard broadcasting live from London. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the Truth Frequency broadcast for this Sunday. I'm broadcasting live from London. This is Chris Everard. And I'd like to thank Chris and Cherie for working so hard this week and actually improving the Truth Frequency network system, because we've got a lot of live listeners from all over the planet tuning in directly on Facebook. And if you go to my Facebook page, be careful because there's lots of fake versions of me, you'll be able to actually listen directly to this show directly on Facebook. You don't need to go to any other website. Now, today I'm going to be giving people an update about what's been going on with regards to the poisoning of the entire Pacific Ocean. That's exactly what's been going on. It's been getting more and more polluted with plutonium, rotting nuclear submarines, which are sitting on the seabed. There were atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs blasted. They actually even exploded and vaporized Pacific islands in the 1950s. This has been done by the British government. It's been done by the French government as well. A Rainbow Warrior ship, there's about three or four of these Rainbow Warrior ships, they're operated by Greenpeace, was docked in Auckland Harbour, and it was bombed by the French security services, the French version, if you like, of MI6. That happened in New Zealand, and today I have a guest, Mr. Vinnie Eastwood, who is a genial type of chap, and he's a broadcaster like me, and he's interviewed lots and lots of people on his radio show. I just want to see whether Vinnie can hear me. Vinnie, can you actually hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's nice to have you on the show. Just before we came on live onto the Truth Frequency, you were telling me that three of the top dudes in New Zealand politics.
Not three of the top three, but the top three.
Oh, the top three. The top three. And they are all Freemasons. And is that actually, you know, kind of public information that's been published in, like, major news feeds in New Zealand?
Well, not saying that three of them are. It has been on mainstream news. There was a mainstream article about how Freemasonry is dying, saying that John Banks, who was the leader of the coalition for the current New Zealand national government, was a Freemason. We have a picture of John Key on freemasons.org.nz, the very front page of him delivering Freemasonic scholarships to people. And we also had another television broadcast as well, where a member of the public asked the current mayor, Lord Mayor of the Auckland Super City, Len Brown, if he was a Freemason on television, and he didn't say no.
Well, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, you know, if anyone is listening to this broadcast, and you know, there's lots of people waking up and they stumble on these broadcasts and they stumble on me on things like YouTube, and I'm sure they stumble across your YouTube interviews with various authors and people that you've done in the last couple of years, Vinny.
Yeah.
What I'd like to say to those people that have just woken up is that, you know, there are many governments around the planet where the top jobs are really basically you know, you can't actually become one of the top people unless you've gone to the right kind of school, unless you're a member of the right kind of secret society, or you've been to the right type of university. And in England, we've got this phrase called the old boy network. Do you say the same thing in New Zealand?
Yeah, we call it the old boys club.
Yeah.
It started a while back. In fact, funny you should mention that. I was talking with one of my listeners and supporters last night, and he used to go to boarding school. And all of these kids were all the daughters, all of the sons, sorry, of doctors, lawyers, judges, high-level politicians. So it's a self-reinforcing, self-perpetuating system of scumbaggery, more or less.
Yes. I think the thing that I've seen in recent years is that, luckily, in terms of big business, I'm talking about multi-billion-dollar corporations, there's been a bit of a digital revolution. And luckily, we've got a few very big corporations that aren't the bosses seem not to be members of this kind of old boy network. A good example would be Apple, where Steve Jobs was a vegetarian, he was a Buddhist, and he spoke openly about his experiences with LSD. And you can't, you know, kind of, I can't really think that a boss of, say, one of the big established old-fashioned Victorian merchant banks would ever speak openly or be a Buddhist or be a vegetarian.
Well, you never know. I've got a favorite saying, it's a tangled web we weave, a tangled, tangled web indeed. And you know what? I can't actually pin most things down. Like, you have certain behavior patterns by which you can recognize a form of scumbaggery, right? Like, somebody gets caught in a lie, or they steal something, or whatever. That's what connotes scumbaggery. Not whether or not they're open about doing LSD, or or things like that. I mean, because, what was his name? Steve Jobs, I read his book, Icon, is a biography, and yeah, he was a pretty whacked out dude. Extremely creative, which means he's probably not a psychopath, and very single-minded, very driven. He fits the classic profile of a entrepreneur, maybe perhaps a slightly narcissistic entrepreneur, but an entrepreneur nonetheless. And quite literally, without his amazing empire, I wouldn't have this really great 27-inch iMac in front of me for which I make all of my radio shows and make all of my videos. In fact, ironically, I had somebody criticize me the other day because now I've got two 27-inch iMacs that are powerful enough to edit HD video. And they say, well, why didn't you contact X person who can build you a computer that will last 10 times as long, blah, blah, blah. You're giving money to the slave labor, etc. You, it's like, come on, right?
Yeah.
If I buy a Kalashnikov, okay, does that mean I'm supporting the Russian military? What if I use that Kalashnikov to defend innocent people from, say, a tyrannical police state or something? Right? Well,
that's a good point. That's a very good point because, you know, they what happened, there was a bomb somewhere. Oh, yeah, the Boston Marathon. This is going back a little while. It's just, you know, fairly recent bomb attack. And obviously they blamed the bomber. But when Sandy Hook took place, they blamed guns rather than the actual person who was responsible for the shooting. I'd like to say to the listeners, by the way, that Sandy Hook, the actual school, has been bulldozed and it doesn't exist any longer.
Whoa.
Did you know that? Did you know that, Vinny?
No.
There's photographs. If you can actually look it up on Google Earth. I mean, you can confirm everything that I'm telling you. Don't just accept everything that I tell you as, you know, verbatim truth. But you can actually do a web search, or you can do a Google Map search, or now there's Apple Maps, apparently, which is eaten into the Google Map market. And you can, you know, type in the coordinates, or you can look at Sandy Hook, and you'll see that the school no longer exists.
Wow.
At all.
Now, you know, that fits the profile with a cover-up. And I think it was like days after the shooting, even on the day of the shooting, there were reports coming out of actors and all of this other kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a real suspicious one. And I don't know, when you become a person like me, who, you know, philosophizes and conspiracy theorizes and whatnot, what it is basically pattern recognition. Okay, certain symptoms, certain incidents, certain phrases, ways of doing things indicate other things that are going on that aren't being explicitly talked about. And I think your game, what was it you talked about on my show, is opposite game, when you watch the news and you repeat
the truth
back.
The truth reversal game.
Yes. And, you know, that's basically how life is. That's how fracked up the world is. Somebody was telling me last night, oh, it's got to change, we've got to do something. And I said, well, that's true, you do have to do something. And they goes, but what do I do? And I go, well, let me ask you something. What currently about society is fracked? The answer is anything and everything. So what can you do about it? And the answer is the same. Anything and everything you can.
Yeah. I mean, I should say to the listeners that the truth reversal game, anyone can play that. All you need is a TV with any news report from the mainstream media. And basically everything that they tell you, what you do is you just reverse the meaning of it. And not every time, but about 90% of the time, which is a very, very high, turnaround, is that when you reverse what they've told you, that is usually much closer to the reality of what's going on. And I just want to say to people that they don't call TV programming for no reason.
Yeah. I mean, here's the news in a nutshell. Today, somebody died, and it was really terrible, and you should be afraid. And also, somebody committed crimes, and it was really terrible, and you should be afraid. And also, here's a fluffy kitten.
Yeah, that's right. It's basically a smorgasbord menu of fear. And, you know, the underlying message on the BBC, I don't know whether this is the same with New Zealand TV mainstream channels. In England, the main kind of subtext of every news report from the BBC is that You need politicians. You need the government and you need the police, because if you didn't have the police and you didn't have the government and you didn't have all these marvelous politicians, then your life would be ruined by crime.
As if they're not the criminals already.
That's right.
So
that's right.
If it I get that- elected the Prime Minister of New Zealand, first of all, I'm going to run as a representative for the Clown Party. Okay, I'm going to have a big wig and red shoes and red nose and the whole gig, stand up there and along with all the other candidates, and say, vote for me, everybody. I'm way less corrupt than the rest of these clowns. And then I'll take off my wig, take off the clown suit, take off the shoes, and underneath will be really, really clean, shaven, nice-looking suit, tie, dress shoes, the whole nine yards. Everything that people think connotes authority and trustworthiness. And then I'll tell them, I only want to pass three pieces of legislation, and they will be the last three pieces of legislation that New Zealand will ever pass. Firstly, when I'm elected Prime Minister, I will pass a law that will actually rename Minister of Parliament, Prime Minister, in fact, rename that word to Sinister. So you'll have the Prime Sinister, the Sinister of Foreign Affairs, the Sinister of Finance, the Sinister of Health, so that everybody will now know the true job of those people in those roles is to be sinister and evil and to do something terrible. And that way you sow the seeds of mistrust in the government so that eventually people will start to have to trust themselves through lack of default. Now, the second piece of legislation, which will be rammed through under urgency with no democratic accountability whatsoever, will be the Suppression of Scumbaggery Act, where a new government department with zero funding will be established to be staffed entirely by volunteers from the community, former private investigators, former police, activists, and so on and so forth, to investigate and be given the power to prosecute elements and agents of scumbaggery that are currently operating in this country that currently aren't held to account by our judicial system. For example...
Good one.
For example, people in the judicial system. And the last one... will be the final piece of legislation, which will be the Suppression of Any Further Legislation Act. So no frickin' law can ever be passed again to encroach upon our freedoms. Thank you.
Wow. Wow, that is great. I mean, those three things there is, you know, I tell you now, the People Power movement in Thailand, they're asking for the entire government to resign and to be replaced by their own People Power kind of parliamentary kind of group. And it's, you know, one of the things that always strikes me as being suspicious is a minister of health will be the minister of health, you know, for a couple of years, and then they'll end up being the minister of transport. And then a couple of years later, you'll see that they've ended up, you know, in the European Parliament for a couple of years, and then they'll come back and they'll be, you know, the minister of some other kind of ministry. None of these people have any qualifications whatsoever. Yeah. Why can't we have bus drivers actually sitting in the Ministry of Transport in all these governments around the world saying, you can't do that. I've been a bus driver for 25 years and this is what I think you should be doing. Why can't we have experts?
Well, frontliners.
Why can't we have members of the public?
Well, we already have real experience. Well, we already do have experts running everything. How's that working out for us? Apparently not well. What we need is frontline people. Okay, frontliners. I spoke to a CIFS worker, CYFS, Child Youth and Family Services New Zealand, our equivalent of CPS, the Child Pedophile Ring of the United States. It's very similar here. And she told me about the leadership structure that nobody, repeat, nobody that has ever been the head CEO of Child Youth and Family Services New Zealand has ever been a caseworker.
Oh, ever. Really?
Not one. Okay?
Yeah. Which
they have zero experience of how to actually run the organization, which is the reason why they got the job in the first place. Because if they were a caseworker whose job it was to actually help people and they weren't one of the pedophile scum whose job it is to rape kids, I think they'd run the organization just a little bit differently and maybe squeeze out the scum.
Yeah. Well, obviously, the other thing is that a lot of these government departments do not want experienced people anywhere near those ministers, because an experienced person, like I said, like a bus driver, say, for example, working at the Ministry of Transport, would be able to work out that, first of all, none of those ministers know what they're talking about. And secondly, they'd be able to work out, hey, there's kind of scams going on and there's corruption going on.
Yeah. Well, hence the reason why you name them all the, you know, the Sinister of Transport, because then he goes for the job at the EU Parliament and they say, what's this? You were the Sinister of Transport. I don't want anybody who's sinister working for me. Bugger off, mate. Mm. So it'll corrupt their job opportunities. Okay. Now, we've got this bill being passed in New Zealand called the GCSB bill, the Government Security Communications Bureau, which is an offshoot of the NSA. In fact, they actually have an office of the NSA in their building in Wellington, the capital of New Zealand.
Really?
Right. Yeah.
I see.
All right. Now, their task is to surveil all activity of New Zealanders. All right? Looking for terrorism. Really? Okay. And I was thinking, okay, well, Mr. Key, who's our Prime Minister, used to work for the Federal Reserve Bank in New York for 2 years, as the head of the European bond and derivatives trade. What caused the 2008 financial crisis again? Never mind. We'll just elect somebody in 2008 that actually caused it to save us from it, of course. I'm going to come in and save you from people like me. And what he does is he comes out and he says to everybody, I'm trying to protect you, I'm trying to help you, I'm trying to save you, you know, from terrorists, bad people, things like that. My question is, Mr. Key, why haven't you installed CCTV cameras in your bedroom and started up a live streaming website so that the citizens can watch you while you sleep?
Hmm.
You're doing it to us. How about you first?
Yeah, well, obviously the politicians don't like that kind of thing.
Well, I that a politician's job should be closer to the occupation of a prisoner. Okay, so you're under surveillance all the time. You have no freedoms, and you don't have any choice about what it is you're actually supposed to do in that job.
Okay? Absolutely. All right? I agree, because that'd stop people like Mr. Pickles, who's one of the British ministers in the British government, and he spent £52,000 of British people's money on biscuits.
Wasn't there also a dude who cleaned his moat with tax pounds?
Yeah, there's been two of those. There's been two, yeah.
How many moats, how many filthy moats are there in England, for frack's sake?
Well, a good question is how many members of the British Parliament actually live in castles that have moats around them? I think there's about three or four of them.
What are they trying to do? Castles. Protect themselves from the revolting slaves?
Yeah, of course. That's the whole idea of you know, what the aristocracy do. It's also what the Vatican have also done as well. Many of the Vatican monasteries that you see around Europe, a good example would be Montserrat. Montserrat Monastery is at the top of a mountain so that, you know, they can get on with their monastic duties, whatever you could say that they were, in complete secrecy. And a lot of the famous monasteries have very, very big, thick, kind of prison-type walls built around them. And obviously that's what the aristocracy have been doing with their castles and their forts. And, you know, that's basically part and parcel of the ruling elite. They're living in a bubble and they're separated from the normal working-class people.
Now,
and, you know, over the centuries and over thousands of years, this has obviously festered a class war. And, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, I write books and I do my documentaries and do broadcasts like this is because I'd like to see a coming together of all of the different classes and a general improvement in the social strata of all of the populations in all the countries around the planet. You know, this is what's really necessary.
Yeah, there's only two classes as far as I'm concerned, the elite and the slaves. And there's very few of the elite.
Yes, that's very true. That is. I mean, you know, there's 7.2 billion people on planet Earth. You know, the revelations of Mr. Ed Snowden is that 5.2 billion smartphones are tracked every day. Well, that's basically every smartphone in the world. And they obviously see the people as the enemy.
Well, it's because we are.
Well, I'm not an enemy of anyone, but...
yes, you are. You know, you're the enemy of anybody who wants to hurt and destroy and kill and maim and lie and frack the world up.
So yeah.
You become an enemy of the enemy of humanity by default if you have any humanity.
Yes. I see what you mean. That's absolutely true. You know, but I don't actually go out of my way to actually cause any problems. What I do is I just investigate things like Fukushima, and I investigate things like the ENIA, European Nuclear Agency. They're actually the Italian Nuclear Authority, and they were paying the mafia to dump nuclear waste in the Mediterranean Sea. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I do. I agree with you. I mean, you automatically make enemies. You know, there are lots of people that send me threats all the time. But that goes with the territory. If I'm not investigating really fascinating stuff and I'm not, you know, helping to spread truth, I'm not doing my job properly.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a little break coming up. We'll be back here with Vinny in New Zealand in about 1.5 minutes. Welcome back. This is the Chris Everard Show, broadcasting live from London. And today we are being carried on FM by Radio Calabria in Italy. We're also going out on the medium wave from Stirling in Scotland, and we're broadcasting globally on the Truth Frequency Radio Network based in Colorado, and that is truthfrequencyradio.com. And my special guest is a broadcaster, a bon viveur, and an all-round nice geezer, and it's Vinny Eastwood, and he's live from New Zealand. Vinny, can you hear me?
I am. I am a nice geezer, kind of like the pyramids.
Now, I want to ask you, Vin, what do New Zealand people think of Obama? I mean, he's trying to start World War III. I mean, are the people in New Zealand actually aware that, you know, he's probably not actually properly qualified through birth for the job of president? I mean, did they know very much about Obama?
Have you ever heard of the phrase, the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so the question is, what do the American people think of Obama? What do the UK people and the Australian people think of Obama? They all think the exact same thing as the New Zealanders do. Why? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right, because we've got an international media that feeds everybody Obama BS.
Yes.
It's Obaminable. And I don't even quite comprehend why people don't see this until I recognise, oh, yeah, that's right. They got educated in public education. They weren't allowed to think from a very young age. That part of their brain atrophied so that they're not able to actually think about things that are concerning anymore, you know?
Well, yeah.
It's time for a fluffy kitten.
Hmm. Now, how many people are actually living in New Zealand now?
Roughly 4 million.
4 million, so it's less than the population of Ireland. But New Zealand, it's got two main islands. So are there any smaller islands in New Zealand?
Oh, heaps. We're an island chain nation. I mean, our two main islands are the North Island and South Island. It was real creative people who came up with them names. And further south, there is Stewart Island, which is our third largest. Then we've got Great Barrier Island, which is off the coast of Auckland, where I live. Wow. And Waiheke Island, which I used to live on for about 8 years. I grew up and there and went to Waiheke Island High School and all of that kind of jazz. And it was really lame. And it's a great place to go for a holiday. If you ever start living there, though, you best already be retired. Otherwise, you're going to get real frickin' bored.
It's bored. Okay, yeah, I'll remember that. Now, there is this Peter Jackson chap, and what he's done is he's actually put together a fantastic company called Weta Digital and a film studio in Wellington, and you've got all of the world's greatest filmmakers actually, you know, now flying into New Zealand, And he's gone and trained up his own kind of army of animators and prop specialists and construction people.
Oh, yeah.
And the Hobbit and quite a few other big films that have grossed. I think they're in the top three biggest films of all time in the last 10 years. Mm. They've either been partly made in New Zealand or wholly made in New Zealand.
Yeah, Avatar's a good example of that. I mean,
yeah.
We have the best animation studios. We've got this... when I say we, New Zealanders seem to think we're all together. We're really not. We're actually all just separate, infighting freaking clowns, basically. I mean, I don't want to insult my own people, but I just can't help myself because I have to tell the truth. And that's the difficulty of being awake and aware and having any idea what the hell is going on, is the frustration starts to set in that you know for a fact that so many people just don't freaking care. However, Weta Workshop is doing really, really well with the guidance of Peter Jackson, and they have extraordinary digital technology there. They've got this massive link cable where they can send like a terabyte per second to the United States.
Wow.
You know, something like something holy ridiculous cow. Like wow. that. It's like insane.
Right.
What's great about this is we're now getting a revitalized New Zealand film industry. And what's really awesome about that is that the massive Hollywood power brokers and everything came over to New Zealand before The Hobbit was signed off on to be made here. They were talking about, oh, we might make it in Eastern Europe instead because it might be cheaper. They're just BSing us because they knew they were going to make it here. The problem is New Zealanders have a thing called employment, okay? And when you're an employee, you get certain privileges. You get holiday pay. You get overtime. You get rights, etc. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they didn't like that. So they came in and they said, okay, well, if we're going to make these movies here, you have to take away all of those employment rights for every single movie, for every single photographer.
Oh, I see.
Every single filmmaker in the entire country, and they all now have to work as private contractors, pay their own taxes, and have zero employment rights whatsoever.
Yeah, well, I've been making movies for many years, and I have to say that this is an unfortunate trait. In the old Hollywood system, the stars, the lighting directors, the animators, the graphic designers, the directors were all on wages, and they were all loyal, and they were all working under the wing of a studio, say, for example, like Paramount Studios, or, you know. And they even lived, actually, at the studio lots, and the studio would provide houses, and everything was run like a, you know, kind of happy family corporation.
Yeah, my former producer, Mitch Santel, if you ever want to have a producer, oh my God, he's just brilliant. And he said that there's only one thing that my job is. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that I do, but the main job, keep the talent happy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, absolutely. But what happened is that, you know, those kinds of old-fashioned, what they actually used to call it, the studio system, that kind of got replaced, you know, with freelance contracting. And the thing about freelance contracting is it's great if you're making a movie and, you know, you're the person who's actually in charge. You just pull the people in and you don't have any legacy for their health benefits. You don't have any legacy for, you know, keeping that person employed. But what's happened is that I know people, this is absolutely verbatim truth. I know people with Oscars. I know people with BAFTA, British Academy Award, the BAFTA awards, like the British version of the Oscars. I know people with these top movie awards, and they've been unemployed for 18 months, or they've been unemployed for 2 years. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for the old-fashioned studio system. What I did notice the last time I was in Hollywood is that the independent studios that do run a family kind of corporate kind of family-run company as their studio, a good example would be Jim Henson, who passed away recently, and he's the inventor, along with Frank Oz, of Kermit the Frog, who's, by the way, Kermit the Frog's actually got one of those stars, you know, on the pavement in Hollywood, which is quite funny because he's a puppet. But the Jim Henson Company were run like a family, and of course they were extremely successful. There's not a country on the planet that's not heard of, you know, the Muppet Show. And then we had Lucasfilms, which has just recently been sold to Disney. Lucasfilms, everyone thinks, oh, Lucasfilms, yeah, George Lucas, it's Hollywood. Well, he was miles away from Hollywood. Lucasfilms was actually up in a vineyard closer to San Francisco than it was to Los Angeles. And, of course, they churned out a certain type of film, and it was made by a close-knit team of people. In more recent years, we've had Robert Rodriguez, who made Desperado, From Dusk Till Dawn, and he's making his movies in his own studio lot in Austin, in Texas, which is a very long way away from Hollywood. And his wife runs the company with him, and they've, in my opinion,
apparently he's editing.
They've made great films.
Apparently, he's editing those movies by himself, just in a little shack kind of thing. Just so you know, a few computers there. With the technology that we've got now, you can bring the ability of Hollywood movie making down to somebody who's only got a few grand in their pocket to buy a camera and a computer.
That's exactly what's happened. That is exactly what has happened, and you're absolutely right. Robert Rodriguez, he actually composes the music, he edits the films, he directs the films, he even has members of his family as extras, or even sometimes as speaking parts in some of the films. He keeps the budgets very low, by Hollywood standards they're very low, and he churns out what I consider pretty good quality films. And what he did is he converted his garage, and these films like Spy Kids, he's made films which have been, you know, when they were on release, they were in the top 10. He's made those films more or less on Macintosh and Pro Tools systems in his garage. Now, Hollywood, you know, is really undergoing this digital revolution right now. And, I can see that some of the studios are open to it. And I'm very glad that Peter Jackson and the Weta Digital people in New Zealand have actually managed to, you know, get, you know, part of that Hollywood production budgeting and financing to actually go into the New Zealand economy.
The unfortunate thing is it's at the expense of all the rights of everybody who works in the New Zealand economy in the film industry.
Yeah,
but you see, it's like that theory about God. With one hand he giveth, and with the other he taketh away. I saw a very great quote from 1976. I think his name was Sam Rockwell or something. I forget his name entirely, but it says, "The large print giveth, and the small print taketh away."
Oh yeah, that's very true. That's very true. But the thing about the rights of the employees, Vin, is that that's happened in lots of industries, and it's happened in lots of countries. It's not just New Zealand.
Oh, yeah, you know? Totally. And New Zealand, in large ways, according to Ian Wishart, who's one of our, I'd probably say the leading journalist in New Zealand. I mean, I'm definitely the lead conspiracy talk radio host, YouTuber in New Zealand. I think the closest mainstream media competitor that I've got on YouTube, I know you don't like YouTube, but they've got, I think, 7,000 subscribers, and I've got nearly 12,000.
Yeah, so well, that's very good.
That's the New Zealand Herald. They're the New York Times of New Zealand, and me by myself in my frickin' office at home with donated equipment and beating the crap out of them. I put an hour and a half's worth of video up every single day. You know,
wow, that's really good. And now, tell the listeners, Vin, who are the types of people that you've had as guests on your show in New Zealand? Because you've got a guest list, which is pretty impressive. You've had some of the most famous authors and researchers. Just give the listeners a little rundown of who you've had.
Well, first of all, I don't kind of discriminate, nor do I research my guests. So I just grab a guest, bring them on. Who are you, and what do you do? And then we have a conversation. You know, that's that way you keep it genuine and nice and good natured. I don't do ambush interviewing or anything like that. Ambush interviewing is something that I do when I'm in person. okay? If the Prime Sinister, for example, is there, I'll ambush him with a camera. If one of our terrible mainstream media people are there, I'll ambush them with a camera. I don't do that on my radio show. My radio show is for good people who have good messages and want a nice, friendly platform with which to share their ideas, like David Icke, George Norrie, Alan Watt, John Perkins, Foster Gamble, Jay Widener, Heinrich Palmgren, Lindsay Williams, Jordan Maxwell, Benjamin Fulford, Douglas Dietrich, Tila Tequila, Ian R. Crane, Andrew Brashago, Nancy Duterte, the Skeptical Psychic, Jan Irvin, John Rush, Rosa Corey, Dr. Janet Hull, Anthony Peake, James Corbett, Robert Menard, Cliff High, Sean David Morton, Sheriff Richard Mack, Catherine Albrecht, Sydney Singer, Ian Wishart, G. Edward Griffin, Stuart and Janet Swerdlow, Len Horowitz, Sherry Kane, Webster Tarpley, Bob Chapman, Steve Quayle, Rick Simpson, John Truman Wolfe, Dr. Rima Labo, Dr. Paul Connett, Anthony J. Hilder, Michael Shaw, Jason Burmis, Lorraine Murray, Reverend Ted Pike, Stan Deo, Kerry Cassidy, Jarrah White, Tamaiti, Cindy Sheehan. You know, the list just goes on and on and on.
Have you interviewed Helen Caldicott?
Let me Google it and find out, because I interview so many people I forget it. Okay, Helen.
Well, she's written a couple of fantastic books, which I can highly recommend to you and the listeners, which really expose and lay open the terrible pollution, bad management, and just insane evilness of the nuclear power industry. And Helen Caldicott, she's really sharp. She's really good. She runs a really, really good website. And when you see her lectures, you know, she just lays out the insanity of the nuclear power industry. A, B, C, 1, 2, 3. There's no pseudo weird kind of strange stuff with her research. These people are completely bonkers. They really are deliberately poisoning our planet. They're poisoning the sea, they're poisoning the soil, they're poisoning the sky. And there's no two ways about it. When you read Helen Caldicott's books, it really makes it very clear to people. And one of the things which I've been doing for years is I've been, you know, trying as much as I can to explain to people that it doesn't matter if a nuclear reactor is live or whether it's offline and it's not creating any electricity. The core is deadly radioactive, and it stays radioactive for 25,000 years. And once you've started it and built it, there's nothing you can do.
Well, you is why you probably shouldn't do it in the first frickin' place, which is exactly why they're doing it in the first frickin' place. You know what I'm saying? It's just... If it's bad, if it's insane, if it's crazy, if it's dangerous... It'll be justified, all right. All right. If it's good, if it's good, if it's helpful, if it's non-damaging, it'll be demonized.
Yeah,
and all covered up, and denied its existence in the first place.
I have to say about New Zealand, Vin, is that New Zealand is one of the very few countries that has got a bunch of government legislation which is basically banning these crazy, bizarre and insane nuclear power stations from actually setting up their businesses in New Zealand.
Oh, allegedly, all right? Because what we've got now is they want to start opening up national parks to mine uranium. So that's good. And then we've had a nuclear ban for 20 plus years, right? But unbeknownst to the New Zealand public, for the entirety of those 20 plus years, Australian mining corporations have been shipping yellow cake uranium through our ports on their way to be enriched in the United States. So everything they tell you is just BS. We had a ship run aground off the coast of Tauranga, a very, very nice little city that we've got here on the coast. called the Rena, which was registered in Lithuania. Why do you register ships in Lithuania? Oh, that's right. They don't have any safety regulations. And ships everywhere around the entire world are registered Lithuanian, even if they're owned by Americans, New Zealand, it doesn't matter. Because of these lax regulations.
They're also registered in Liberia as well.
Oh, wait, sorry. Nation. That's the one. Liberia,
oh, yeah,
not
Liberia is like an amazing place. If you've seen the Nicolas Cage movie, The God of War, The Lord of War, you'll see that there's a character there who, you know, is based on real-life dictators like Idi Amin, and he comes from Liberia. Liberia is actually, believe it or not, it's actually controlled by Buckingham Palace, and it's one of the major sources of rough diamonds, quartzite, and I think emeralds. I think it's rich in emeralds in Liberia as well.
All right, I got to remember Liberia. Just remember it's Siberia, except it's not true.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you're right. Liberia is where they register all the super tankers.
All right, so anyway, one of these big super tankers with umpteen carriages and containers all over it runs aground in New Zealand and splits in half. And you have all this thick Marmite-y type engine oil all over the place. What does the New Zealand government do within hours? Oh, they start spraying it with Corexit 9500.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, that is extremely toxic stuff.
Yeah.
Corexit is sometimes more toxic than the actual load which they're spraying. It's incredible.
Well, that's the intention. It's a biological chemical weapon, I think. That's my personal appraisal.
Oh, I agree. I agree. Corexit is just like any marine life that comes into contact and is directly sprayed. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's a seabird, or it could be a seal, it could be a mammal, it could be a fish, it doesn't matter. It could be shellfish.
Albatross!
Yeah. The Corexit will actually reduce the lifespan of whatever sea life comes into contact with it. No question.
You know, I've got this real aversion. Like, people don't actually know anything about New Zealand, okay? I do. I know a lot about New Zealand, way more now than I did years ago, because I've interviewed activists, right? Mm-hmm. I figure activists are now the reporters, okay? Let's face it. Reporters are idiots, and they don't know what they're talking about. Those are the two general rules of thumb. Are you an idiot? Yes. Do you not know what you're talking about? Yes. Okay, you're going to be a reporter then. Here's a microphone. Here's a douchebag cameraman. Go out and ask stupid questions and don't demand answers, okay? Okay. Right, that's a reporter. Here's an activist. Okay, have you got anything to lose? No, they've already taken everything from me. Okay, here's a microphone. Here's a camera. Go out there. Be hardcore. Ask those tough questions. Do the investigation and report it back to people. What I've done with my show is I have taken those activists who previously get ignored, shoved to the side, demonized, locked up without trial. Everything that is bad that is happening to these people, I believe, is happening for a very specific reason, because they're onto something. Lancaster bomber pilots who were bombing Germany in World War II had a saying: when you're copping the flak, you're over the target. And I think that these people, who have nothing left to lose, who've already had everything taken from them, including their freedom, their businesses, their, in some cases, much of their sanity has, in fact, been taken from them deliberately. Mm-hmm. These people explain things, not in a soundbite, but in long form. And that's why I do like two-hour interviews, Chris, because you can't encapsulate the scumbaggery within a few minutes. You know, I really get frustrated because I see great journalists like, say, Ian Wishart, for instance, being interviewed and having a debate with the Cancer Society for 12 minutes. 12 minutes! That's all they're giving him. I would have given him 4 hours, you know?
Yeah, well, I do have a saying. I know it's using foul language, which I try to avoid on air, but bullshit has all the best sound bites.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're going to try and explain to somebody who, you know, believes everything that they see on the mainstream news reports and are totally unaware of the pollution and the destruction that's been going on the planet. And they just trust supermarkets and they trust food corporations to be honest, you know, and they trust the educational system to teach their children. You know, when you try and have conversations with those people, you really cannot summarize what is going on, and you cannot summarize big subjects like propaganda and how subtle it is in TV commercials and television broadcasts. You just can't do that in like 30 seconds flat.
No, and I live life on rafts of different assumptions, and I think we all do. Here's two general assumptions. If you want to be close to the truth, but not actually know anything, okay? Assumption number one, if it comes from an official source, it's probably the exact opposite of what they're telling you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if it's called the health system, it's probably there to kill you. If it's called the defense system, it's probably there to attack people, right? Okay, so there's assumption number one. Assumption number two, if you can't make it in your own kitchen, then it's a soft kill bioweapon.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Now, we have a break coming up very soon in about 3 minutes. My guest today is Mr. Vinnie Eastwood. He's a gentleman from New Zealand. He's interviewed many of the leading activists and researchers around the planet. And we are broadcasting live on the Truth Frequency Radio Network, which is truthfrequencyradio.com. You can tune in directly from your Facebook page by simply clicking on our link. And we're also being carried on FM at Radio Calabria in the south of Italy. And we're also on medium wave AM in Stirling in Scotland. And my name is Chris Everard. And if you want to check out my website, my personal website, it's ChristopherEverard.com. And if you want to have a look at a trailer for a new motion picture documentary, which I've been working on for the last 3 years, which exposes three global empires of voodoo, and this is all real. I mean, none of this is made up. Then you can go to the Enigma channel, and that's enigmatv.com, and click on the link that says movies, and you'll be able to watch a pretty long snippet of my film. I've been doing it for 3 years, and there's the world's richest billionaires and trillionaires all featured in my movie. People like Nelson Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, who at one time was the richest man on the planet, and many other very, very prominent politicians and leading people are featured in my movie Spirit World. Okay, now we have a short break coming up. When we get back, we're going to be discussing fracking and lots of other interesting things with my special guest, Mr. Vin Eastwood, live from New Zealand.
London calling. This is London calling on Longwave. London calling. This is Westminster.
I am not a man. I am a free man.
Calm down. I'm okay. With a combat unit that's armed with automatic weapons.
Come on, Mrs. Jones. You've got to go to your second job now. You've got to earn extra money to pay the bedroom tax.
I'm very lucky. I've got a second job in a chemical plant. Yeah, I'm making fluoride for Syria. They're shipping it to Syria.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to join Chris Everard in an undisclosed location deep under Buckingham Palace in Winston Churchill's war bunker.
Let's never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories.
God damn it, boy! These Brits are coming to get us!
Welcome, my friends, to the show which never ends.
My husband and I are not amused.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
Deep from inside the former communist block, where we now torture American citizens in Poland and the Balkan states, we're tuning in to the Chris Everard Show.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Chris Everard, and we are broadcasting live on the Truth Frequency. Welcome back. This is Chris Everard broadcasting live from London. My special guest today is Mr. Vinnie Eastwood from New Zealand. Vinnie, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
One of the things I'd like to discuss with you, and I'm always interested in discussing this with New Zealanders and also Australians, is what is the current state of play with the popularity of the British royal family in New Zealand?
I don't know. Honestly, not too much fanfare about it.
Really?
No.
I mean, is there a member
apart
of the royal
from that royal wedding, where it was so classic. One of those bishops or whatever it was at the Abbey had a giant upside down pentagram on his back.
I saw that.
Just in full view. David Icke showed me that. I thought it was classic.
Yes, absolutely. Well, unfortunately, there's lots of religious regalia that does have weird pagan and satanic kind of iconography. There's a giant cathedral. It's one of the largest cathedrals in Europe, a French town called Amiens. It's an awful place, actually. It's like a concrete wasteland. And, they have these giant stained glass windows in these cathedrals, and it's got an inverted pentagram actually in the window, in the stained glass window of this cathedral. It's meant to be, for Christ. But it obviously, the Vatican has been exposed over the years. Do New Zealanders understand what's been going on with the Vatty leaks and the Vatican Bank scandals? Has that been covered in the New Zealand media?
No. Of course
it hasn't.
Of course they don't.
Really?
All right.
Wow.
Do the people of England understand all of that? No? No.
Well, they understand that Jimmy Savile rather suspiciously was given the equivalent of a knighthood by the Pope, and they're all now wondering what on earth was going on. And they also, amazingly, most people in Britain do know now that Prince Charles was not only friends with Jimmy Savile, but was actually visiting Jimmy Savile's house Scotland.
Can I make a detraction a little bit here? When we make generalizations about what the people know, when people say things like, most people, have you talked to most people? And the answer is obviously not. Nobody knows what most people think because nobody does polling. Have you done polling? I haven't done. But what I see is the effects. Okay, so let's act under the assumption that everybody in England knew that the Pope and the satanic Vatican or whatever were all full-on scumbaggery. Did everybody in the whole of England convert from Catholicism that day when that information came out? No. There was no spike. There was nothing even noticeable. So the answer is people don't give a frack, all right? And I think that is actually, you've asked me a lot about what New Zealanders think about this, what New Zealanders think about that. My answer is New Zealanders, on the whole, don't think at all.
Oh, that's terrible.
And that's unfortunate because it's the same for everybody everywhere. And it's not New Zealanders or anybody else's fault per se that they can't think. It's been forced upon them. Okay, it's an enforced ignorance, and it's really sad because they it's kind of like, how could you come into the world, all of a sudden you are thrust into
a grand designed prison. Okay, and you don't even know it's a prison. You're not told it's a prison. And then you start being educated in this prison. And they tell you, you have to be a slave, you have to be a slave. Being a slave is good. And you're like, really? That doesn't make any sense. Shut up. You're going to get detention if you don't think being a slave is good. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, that's trauma-based mind control, isn't it? That's what I figured out that school, high school was, trauma-based mind control.
Absolutely.
Were you traumatized in high school? I was. I don't know.
if you managed to make your way through a whole school day at my school without being stabbed, you did very well, let alone whether you'd learn anything that day. That's the kind of school I went to.
Mate.
And it was extremely violent. And it was violent from the management top level down to, you know, the what I call the shop floor level of the school classroom. Mm. The top boss, the headmaster, actually got busted. This is how bad my school was. He actually ended up teaching at Cambridge University, and he was such a megalomaniac and he was such a psychopath. He actually got busted at the University of Cambridge for telling master of degree students, which are kind of grown adults, not to walk on the grass. He was such a control freak. He used to stand on the roof of the building of my school with a pair of naval binoculars, actually, you know, like a spy. That's how he used to spend his lunch hours.
Sweet.
It was incredible. It was like going to Colditz rather than going to school.
It's not as bad as some of the stories I've heard from South African schools. I think one of the teachers was just selling drugs to the students and what have you. One of the teachers was completely crazy, and he brought in this bird that had been run over by a car. Like it's flat, you know, like a frisbee. And he brings it into the class, puts it in a shoebox, gives it water and seed and stuff, but tries to feed it for a couple of... It's dead! It's freaking dead, bro! And then a couple of weeks later, he throws it out the window like a frisbee and says, yeah, it's all better now. And another mate was telling me...
Weird.
He was... They have these 15, 20-foot fences or something like that around their school. And on the other side of the fences was all these slums with all these homeless people and bums everywhere. And every single time, not every once in a while, but every single time they would accidentally kick a ball over the fence, a bum would dive on it and stab it with a knife.
Oh dear. Well, I have to say to the listeners
and,
that, you know,
and that's not the best part. The best part is that the children, in revenge for getting their balls stabbed, would kill the bum by throwing rocks at him.
Oh dear!
It was rough,
is
man.
Is that South Africa?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's after Mandela.
Yeah. Absolutely. I have to say that you know, England, where I grew up, is famous for having the aristocratic public schools, but when we say public school in England, what we actually mean is private schools that charge about, you know, usually around £15,000 a year to send your children. And obviously they're run as businesses. And the reason that so many children from the public school system end up with drug habits is because they basically they're allowed to do whatever they want at school. And I just want to say to parents, I mean, I've been a lecturer at Goldsmiths in London, and I've lectured at many of the top universities, and I have many of those students from the public school system. And I can tell you now, you know, they've confessed to me what goes on, basically because they're not really going to school. They're actually spending their time inside a business, and the business makes its profits from those children. Those public schools let the kids do whatever they want. They let them swear. They let them go out to discotheques. They when they're meant to be studying. They let them cheat in their exams. They let them take their drugs because, you know, they don't want to lose those students, because every single student is a unit of monetary profit for the public school system. And then the government school system in England is really on its last knees. I mean, it's really bad. I mean, I could dedicate several shows to telling people what I've seen from the inside.
I like it's how disgusting. You said last knees instead of last legs, because I already lost them legs a long time ago.
That's right. Is that similar in New Zealand? Is it kind absolutely. Of like that in New Zealand?
Absolutely. And the UN Agenda 21 protocols for education are being implemented here big time. They've, I think about the year after I left school, they implemented what are called unit standards. Now, previously we had school certificate, which was you work all year and 100% of your assessment is based upon an exam at the end of the year. Really, really hard to do. You've got to study an entire year's worth of work in order to hopefully pass the exam. Mm. And now they have about the last part of the year is only 30% exam, and all the rest of it is like 70% of you get judged throughout the year. And it's so much easier that you don't even have to be that bright in order to get like A pluses and what have you. Like,
oh, really?
A person of average intelligence could get A plus. A person of genius intelligence would just sit there bored out of their minds and probably wind up getting detention for fiddling or disturbing other students.
I heard a very great story. It's a total dumbing down, then.
Well, that's the New World Order agenda in a nutshell, isn't it? You know, making everybody stupid. So. They won't have any idea what the heck is going on. You can just you can. So, like, somebody says, "Oh, the truth has to eventually come out." Are you joking? Have you looked at history? They can keep stuff secret forever, forever. I mean, look, it's about personal choice. Okay, so if you go into the school system and you say, "I'm going to have a personal choice here," to tell the teacher, "Frack you, you're teaching me BS. You know you're teaching me BS. I ain't going to do it. Try and send me to detention. I ain't going to turn up. Try and call my parents. Or try and, well, try and do me
what you've just described there is you've described me at my school, because when I was 7 years old, I used to stand up against the teachers and I used to actually hold up, you know, whatever textbook they'd given us. And I used to say, and I was 7 years old, I used to say, "Why have you chosen this book and why are you teaching us this?" And they say, "Sit down, Everard." And, you know, I was a rebel, and they earmarked me as a rebel when I was 7 years old. By the time I got to my bigger school, there was a file on me, and they actually showed me the file on me, and it was already half an inch thick, and I was 11 years old.
he's got a record.
Yeah, I did. I have a very big big record.
It reminds me of what George Carlin said. He says, "I've got this real problem. I think," and that's it. It's a real problem when you think.
Yeah, there was a famous quote from Ronald Reagan, who, let's face it, he wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he was good at making public speeches, and, you know, that's why they hired him as a puppet president. But he did do an excellent speech all about his education years, and he said one of the biggest benefit of being president of the United States is that on the day that I was sworn in, all my school records were made secret. Because he was one of these flunkers at school. But, you know, I say this in many broadcasts, you do not need any qualification whatsoever to be a government minister or a member of parliament, which I find amazing, especially considering that they hire their own wives in many instances to be the secretary of their office in the Houses of Parliament. Now, is she qualified to be a secretary? No. The elite, and when I say the elite, I'm obviously talking about the royal political elite. I'm talking about Buckingham Palace. They want unqualified people. In actual fact, they want unqualified people that have got skeletons in their closets, because it's much easier to blackmail them. Mm. Absolutely.
Apparently, there's this massive file that MI6 or MI5, one of the intelligence have got, about all of the famous and powerful people in England or something like that. Like, they got dirt on everybody. And if you ever step out of line, You ever start talking bad about us? Yeah. Oh, matey potatey, we've got a good way to make everybody think you're a scumbag, which you actually
are.
That's
right.
But right at the moment, you're lucky because you're our scumbag.
Yeah. And also, obviously, they also invent evidence as well. This is also something which is going on now in the digital age. When you go and see these movies with these fantastic digital special effects like Spider-Man, you know, you see Spider-Man going down Manhattan, down Fifth Avenue, and it looks as real could be. I mean, nowadays, digital video technology, Hollywood technology, if you can think it, you can put it on the screen. And not only can you put it on the screen, but it can look so real that, you know, people just would believe it. Now, that exact same technology is also being used to frame people as well. Photoshop, Pixelmator, RenderMan, all of the big high-end animation systems. And we know this. We know it from, say, for example, the fake Bin Laden videos. We know it from the videos that have been released, you know, trying to make normal members of the public in countries like Iraq look terrible. Well, they're animations, everyone. And very much what you see on the TV news, elements of what you see on the TV news are not real. And it's like a blurring of fact and fiction. It is actually a mind control merry-go-round, which you're seeing when you tune into the mainstream media.
I wondered what the limits to mind control were and whether or not you could actually derive some benefit in it. What if you could brainwash somebody into thinking that they're not part of a collective, that they're actually an individual, that they don't want to be a slave, that they want to fight for freedom, that they want to help rather than hurt people? What if you brainwashed somebody into thinking that? What if you brainwashed people, used a mind control technique to teach people the truth?
Yeah, well, what you've just described there is Scientology. I mean, Scientology is one of these subjects that, you know, people shoot from the hip without actually studying properly what is going on in Scientology. When you see the top Hollywood people who are members of Scientology, you know, you have to look at it in the cold light of day. Those people are not idiots. Those people in Hollywood, you know, if you look at the output of Hollywood, it takes great skill to do what they do. There's great amounts of work that go into creative shows like The Simpsons, South Park, you know, Star Wars films. You need the best editors. You need the best animators. You need the best actors.
Did you see the South Park episode about Scientology?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, that was brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason that you've got top Hollywood people as members of Scientology, and I'm not talking about the high level celebrities. It's not just them. There's many people that you do not see on the cinema screen or on the television screen who work in Hollywood who are also Scientologists. The reason that these very intelligent, you know, they are on average much more educated than the average American person, the reason that they've got involved in Scientology is because Scientology actually tells them about the New World Order. It actually tells them about brotherhoods. It tells them about magic. It tells them about government corruption. It tells them about people with criminal minds. It actually tells them, it uses a special kind of language, Scientology. There's many initials which are used to, you know, like somebody with a suppressive personality is what me and you, Vinny, would describe as a douchebag politician.
Well, I found very interesting about the Scientology belief structure is that they actually believe, and the science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard created this religion, they actually believe, what was it, B-52 bombers traveled across space in order to deliver human souls to a volcano.
That's right. I think it was real beings. They were real humans, and they were placed in volcanoes, and then atomic bombs were dropped into the volcanoes. And the spirits of those humans, called thetans, are what we're dealing with now.
The fact that they actually used B-52 bombers, which weren't invented until the Second World War. Were they B-52s? I forget what kind of plane they were, but they were a World War II bomber.
They weren't planes. It just said that they were in spaceships which resembled, I think, DC-10s or something like that. But what I was going to say is that they are members of Scientology because they have been told about the New World Order. And they have been told that it's L. Ron Hubbard's technology, the clear meters and the other different types of Hubbard technology, which is going to cure the New World Order. And they see corrupt people not as corrupt people, but as suppressive personalities. They call them SPs. And the recruitment drive... And they actually have a celebrity center in Los Angeles, in Hollywood. The recruitment drive of Scientology is taking elements of truth, elements of corruption, which really do exist, which all the truthers in the truth movement, people like John Lennon, Monsignor Bruce Kent, Noam Chomsky, Norman Finkelstein, all of the, you know, main kind of authors that expose corruption, Michael Moore and all these people, Scientology is very, very cleverly using that information, which is real and which is true, and then creating a tapestry of amazing kind of mind-blowing stuff, you know, which is really basically what the Book of Enoch, the Book of Revelations, and all the apocryphal ancient texts do. I mean, you know, the Book of Revelations is like a sci-fi extravaganza from the ancient world. And you see, L. Ron Hubbard was not a silly man. He was a very clever man, but he was a disciple of Aleister Crowley. And the negative sides of Hubbard's career as a magician is kept secret from those Scientologists, and it's very unfortunate that these very bright, clever people in Hollywood, and also in other countries, and it's not just Hollywood, have been duped.
Can I make an observation?
Yeah.
It's a lack of self-analysis. Have you heard of the Ballad of the Cosmic Schmuck?
No.
No? Okay. Let's say you're the cosmic schmuck. Cosmic meaning big, schmuck meaning idiot, right? And you say to yourself, am I the cosmic schmuck? It's extremely unlikely that you'll actually be the cosmic schmuck because you're questioning yourself. But if it never occurs to you and you never ask yourself that question, am I the cosmic schmuck? Then you probably are. You understand? Mm. The more intelligent, the more confident in yourself that you are, the more likely it is that you'll be able to lie to yourself effectively without questioning your decision.
Mm-hmm.
And thus, that ability is transposed and actually given to other people. Because I think psychopaths are really good at manipulating people because they don't actually show you their face. Okay? They never show you their face. They show you a mirror image. They show you what you think you want to see. They tell you what you want to hear. And then they use that to bring all your defenses down so that they can then manipulate and control and then eventually destroy and suck the life out of you. You know, vampirically kind of mm-hmm. thing. Kind of like being in a trance. And this is something that happens in any situation where you have power or control. Any situation with power or control, that where it's accumulated, that's where psychopaths will gravitate to. They'll gravitate towards, I think the American Medical Journal released a list of employment opportunities for psychopaths, right? This is where the industries that they work in. Business, media, politics, medicine, law, religion. You know? And you think to yourself, what are all the main power and control centers of the entire planet that influence our main culture?
Yeah, what you've just said there, Vin, is that they are the so-called pillars of society.
Yeah. Well, actually, they're the pillage of society.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
That's what they do.
They absolutely are.
It's going to have a. It's going to come to a war. Like we're already in the middle of like this massive quagmire. Okay, it's almost like the truth movement versus the scumbaggery movement are sort of engaged in our own little Vietnam right now. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
One side's obviously eventually going to lose, but the problem is you're completely lost in the fog of war right now that you cannot see or grasp your victory.
Absolutely. Now, we have a very short break coming up. When we come back, we've just got the last section of the show. Stay with us. It's a short break of 90 seconds. This is the Truth Frequency live from London. Welcome back. This is Chris Everard broadcasting live from London on the Truth Frequency radio network in the USA, on AM from Stirling in Scotland, and also on Radio Calabria on FM in Italy. And my special guest today is Mr. Vin Eastwood, who's a bon viveur and an all-round interesting dude who's interviewed a lot of activists and authors. And I'd just like to say to you, Vin, that there's a quote here from Edward Snowden, and he says, "A child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. They'll never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves, an unrecorded, unanalyzed thought. And that's a problem because privacy matters. Privacy is what allows us to determine who we are and who we want to be."
Privacy, as I've quoted myself as saying, privacy is freedom. When you no longer have privacy, you no longer have freedom. It's just that mm-hmm. simple.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, like you were saying earlier in the show, all these people who say, you know, well, if you've got nothing to hide, you know, why are you worried about it? And obviously, when you turn around to those people and say, okay, well, you know, we'll have your house surrounded by security cameras and we'll follow you down the road with a camera crew. And even when you go to bed, there'll be a camera crew with microphones there, you know. They don't like it.
I did that to a cop once. He's like, "Can you turn your camera off, please?" And I go, "Why? You don't have anything to hide, do you?" He got really pissed off.
That's right. They don't like that kind of, they don't like that kind of thing. I film people for my documentaries on the street in many different countries. I have to say that my experience is that I've been lucky, and I was filming actually in Italy. And the Italian police were very good with me. And, you know, they said, who are you and why are you filming these government buildings? And I explained to them. And, you know, they were very friendly. But most of the time I see little clips on video sharing websites of the police putting their hands over the lenses of cameras. Well,
oh, can I have a great anecdote here to add. Yeah. And so an article just came out. Rialto, California, have mm-hmm. passed a law that mandates that every time their police officers have any interaction with the public, they have to turn their camera on. They have a little camera attached to their sunglasses.
That's right.
That has a microphone as well. It reduced the amount of police brutality by 60%.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
And it reduced the amount of police complaints by 80%.
Yeah.
So, can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
When the government passes a law to surveil the people, I think they should actually only surveil themselves. If you're a person, a normal individual or what have you, you should never be surveilled. All right, basically, unless there's a warrant or probable cause, some kind of actual reason. But if you're a government employee or a police officer or somebody that's otherwise in a level of fiduciary responsibility, whenever you're performing your duties, I think it should be recorded to ensure accountability because, hey, all the ordinary people have no power. There's no ability for them to actually really do a whole lot of corrupt stuff to a large degree and cover it up because they don't work in the establishment. They're not part of the clique. The people who are part of the clique, on the other hand, would never want that kind of surveillance measure to be implemented on them because it's like, damn, they're going to see the video of me raping those small children. Damn, I can't do that anymore. I'd have to get another job.
Yeah, you know, I was going to say to people, if ever you get your camcorder out or your iPhone, and the police try and stop you from doing that, and you are in a public space, you can quote to them that you are actually enabled under law to be able to use your camera in a public space. I think really they're going to start tightening up on this because, I'm making this new film called Wow, World of Wonder. You can actually see the trailer. If you go to wowthemovie.net, you can see that me and a lot of people around the planet, I'm assembling this big team of people that use mini helicopter drone cameras, and we've been filming all the ancient sites around the world. And we've been filming in Egypt. We filmed Stonehenge, Avebury. We filmed Venice. And we filmed everywhere. We filmed in the USA as well just recently. And the police obviously, see our drone cameras. And you can see in their eyes what's going through their minds. They're thinking, this shouldn't be allowed. But we speak to all of the police. I mean, they came up to us in London and we were talking to them. And they asked to have a look at our drone cameras. We showed it to them. And I think what they're going to try and do is they're going to try and clamp down on it, which is, bad because we're just members of the public and we're filming public spaces. We're not invading privacy with our flying cameras.
Mm. Well, it's one mind at a time. I mean, and go back to the Vietnam War analogy, part of the US plan was to win the hearts and minds of the people by giving them candy and fresh socks and what have you, Yeah. Just like, we've actually got that same kind of campaign on the streets. You've got to convert police officers now. You've got to convert politicians, And
yeah.
Being devoted to the truth, being willing to suffer death threats, and maybe even at the cost of your life. Nobody wants to die, but unfortunately, it is part of the realm in which we live.
Yes.
This is a religion. Okay, unfortunately, that's my conclusion, that the truth is, in and of itself, a religion. Mm. Not unlike science, not unlike Catholicism, there are those things. Now, what a religion, or rather what good I define as, is restraint. Okay? Evil, I define as lack of restraint. And those are the basic simple principles. And when you first start out knowing the truth, being into this indoctrinated religion of, oh my God, there's a new world order, they're evil, they're scumbags, they're going to kill us and everything like that, you've got all these different paths to go down, all these different directions. And it's only once you've actually kind of stumbled along a whole bunch of different rabbit holes that you realize that it doesn't actually matter how deep that rabbit hole goes. What matters is how far to the side of the rabbit hole you can get before you hit the wall. Right? You know what I'm saying? And what I find is interesting is that if you use humor, smiles, and manipulative tactics, to be honest, I'm actually a fan of manipulation, all right? By its very definition, manipulation isn't actually a bad thing, okay? You can manipulate a pen to write a great art work or something of that nature, like a poem. But the thing is, manipulation's being misused. Okay, if you come up with the right words, the right phrase, at the right time, you can turn somebody who is otherwise a freedom-hating slave into a freedom-loving zealot. Okay, same thing happened to me. Same thing happened to nearly everybody else in this movement that I've talked to. Somebody, somewhere, at some point, gave you that information. Somebody instilled it within you. And what I really get frustrated with is people within this movement who don't do anything, don't wake anybody up, only sit around listening to other people on the radio and watching other people's YouTube videos, not doing any of themselves, getting depressed and saying that nobody's waking up and there's no point trying. Okay? Well, of course there's no freaking point trying because you're not actually trying, you stupid knob. Okay? For frack's sake. There's an entire planet full of people. There's 7 billion people on the planet. Why do you want to hang around people who never encourage you? People who never actually teach you anything? We've all got these old friends from high school and what have you. You know how many friends of mine from high school I'm still in touch with? None of them. None of them from university, none of them from primary school, none of them from any of my previous employment opportunities. None of them. I'm not in touch with any of them at all because they're not
into reality. They don't like it. Some people think that reality doesn't exist. I'll tell you what. Shoot yourself in the head. Okay? No, seriously. If you think perception is reality, find a gun, shoot yourself in the head, and try to perceive that that bullet won't travel through your skull and kill you. Okay?
Yeah.
If that's... Okay? Courage of your convictions. I've got courage of my convictions, knowing that I can actually make a difference in people's lives. I've had people who were about to commit suicide before they listened to my radio show, started laughing about how terrible everything is, like I do, and they suddenly realize, you know, life's actually worth living. Even Donald Trump was about to commit suicide this one time, walking across a bridge, he's about to throw himself off. And as he steps onto the bridge, firstly, he gets encountered by this Vietnam vet who had no legs, who was, using his hands to propel himself along on a skateboard. And he's selling pencils. And he says, "Mr. Trump, would you buy a pencil? Would you buy a pencil, please?" You know, reaching up to him. Mr. Trump goes, "Sure, I'm gonna kill myself anyway. Just give him $100. Here we are, $100 for a pencil." And the veteran goes, "Well, thank you, Mr. Trump, but I have to give you your change." And Trump's just like, no, it's fine. He keeps walking. The guy actually is just wheeling after him on the skateboard, saying, "Mr. Trump, I need you to give you your change. Mr. Trump, please stop." Mm-hmm. About halfway across the bridge, Donald Trump decided, "You know what? I don't actually have it that bad. I'm not going to top myself." You know?
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately, yeah, that is good, but unfortunately, if the guy selling the pencils had tried to do that with Himmler or Joseph Mengele or Hitler, they would have picked that veteran up and thrown him over the bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there are psychopaths that are actually in senior positions of government.
There's another thing that kind of occurred to me. I would never implement it because it provokes too many moral grey areas and too much potential for the extermination of innocence, is psychopathy, if you can be clinically diagnosed, 100% absolutely diagnosed psychopath, should you be executed for it, right? And the answer is absolutely not, because, you know, the only thing that would happen is psychopaths would wind up controlling that system, and they'd wind up eliminating the low-level psychopaths. You know, the ones on the ones on the street that would kill you for the money in your wallet kind of thing, who just love fracking things up. Those would be the ones that wind up getting executed, and the ones executing them would be the judges and the lawyers and so on and so forth, who are even worse psychopaths than they are.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to say that the New World Order would not work, and it would not be able to corral and sheepdog manage the human population were it not for the Pentagon, the Ministry of Defense, all of the police forces around the planet, actually specifically employing people with psychopathic tendencies. I've seen many police officers when I was living in London who, you know, they would turn up if they'd been called to the scene of a crime. Maybe I remember a time when my neighbor called the police to report that his car had been stolen, and the police officer was trying to arrest him, my neighbor. And, you know, the guy that turned up was a complete idiot. Well, I say idiot, but he was an actual psychopath. Then I met a British army soldier who'd actually deserted the army because he joined up. He came from a very underprivileged area. And he, you know, like many people, joined the army because that was the only thing that he could think of doing, and there was no employment there. And after a while, he realized, oh dear, I've made the biggest mistake of my life. And he told me that there were psychopaths who enjoyed killing who were actually deliberately sought out and employed by the Ministry of Defense.
Wow.
And they were so dangerous that they actually kept them separate from the rest of the men in the battalions in a kind of prison barracks. And they had their own little kind of brick cells. And these are the guys that, you know, were there, and they were loving any opportunity to go to Iraq, Afghanistan, anywhere where they would have a gun, live ammunition, and a knife and they would be let loose. They couldn't wait to get out there and start killing people. And these guys were sought out by the Ministry of Defence officers.
Well, yeah, and the same thing happens with police officers, actually. The aptitude tests, when they ask you questions about morals, ethics, those kind of things, and when they test your intelligence, they're not looking for people that have high moral ethics and high intelligence. They're looking for people that have no morals and very low intelligence. Right? A friend of mine was rejected from the Australian police because his IQ test came back too high. And they say, sorry, no, we can't have you in the police. Which explains a lot of Australian police.
Oh dear.
You know, and just think about it. How many cops have you talked to who have wowed you with their intelligence? I haven't spoken to one. Ever.
I did meet one police officer.
Apart from Albert Burgess, who took the who took control and actually arrested a judge in an English. He's former cop though as well. In fact, here's another thing. Current police employment means you're an idiot. Former police employment means you're actually probably pretty bright because you realise how bad it was and got out, right?
Yeah.
I interviewed, and in fact, one of the best interviews, and the reason why it's still on the Vinnie Eastwood Show featured interviews page, is Grace Hayden, 15-year prosecuting sergeant with the New Zealand Police. And this was back in 2010 when I interviewed her. And she told me something I'll never ever forget. The New Zealand Police are so corrupt that you will either become corrupted by them, or you will leave. And I left.
Wow. Yeah. Now, Vinny, we're going to come up to the last part of the show, and there's a very important subject that's close to my heart, and these people fascinate me, and they are the Maoris of New Zealand. Could you just tell people, you know, who've never been to New Zealand, what the state of play is with the indigenous Maori people? Because obviously, you know, they were there, and then all of these European, mostly British settlers just turned up. And before we all turned up, I presume the Maoris have been there for thousands of years. Is that the case?
One Maori scholar who I spoke to said, oh, we've always been here.
I see.
She didn't provide any evidence to that extent, but she was pretty onto it. Very, very respected within the community. Some of the elders that I've spoken to have said that when you've got to understand Māori, you've got to go back to the beginning. Okay, so Māori tradition says they came there around about 900 AD or so, right?
Okay.
And then they lived there. There were these big birds called moa that were like these giant ostrich-type creatures that they killed all off. Many of the tribes, not all of them, mind you, in fact, the majority of the tribes didn't resort to this, but many of the tribes, particularly inland, took to cannibalism. In fact, that was Captain James Cook's first encounter with Māori, as he launched a longboat and he didn't find any of his men that went to shore. So he went looking around.
I'd just like to say at that point that these histories that we are taught at school about the indigenous people in the lands that were taken over by Buckingham Palace, that's what we're talking about here, folks.
Yeah.
A lot of those histories are deliberately bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I'm telling you the stuff that they don't teach you in school.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So James Cook came here, sent a longboat ashore. Every single one of the people on that longboat got eaten, right, within hours of landing by a really aggressive Māori tribe. Now, after that, the English settlers started coming in, and they found out that the Māori were very easy to manipulate. You could give them alcohol, and they'd start getting drunk and violent, and then you could just say, oh, this person's drunk and violent, let's take their land off them. So they did, and then the Māori got really effed off about it after they sobered up, and then decided that they would have some kind of retribution. There were a couple of tribes that made a really good go of commercialism. In fact, Parihaka was a was an interesting place. I've got a couple of stones from Parihaka that one of my listeners gave me from the site itself, sitting on my mantle. And they were really, really successful. They were getting trade up to wazoo. They had their own trading flags and everything like that. It was called the United Tribes flag. And so the English said, these guys are beating us at our own game. So let's kill them all, every single one of them.
Oh dear.
And confiscate all of their property, their land, and their businesses and everything. And they did. And so the Māori got really effed off.
I presume this was in the 1800s, was it?
I think so, yeah. And so naturally they got really effed off with, about that, and a big war started, but the war started after the treaty, okay? Because the Māori were actually afraid of the French. The French were really, really vicious, much more vicious than the British. And when we had a treaty signed up, draft document called the Littlewood Treaty, it was found not too long ago, the original document, these chiefs at the time didn't even debate that treaty. They signed it really, really quickly because they hated the French and they knew and they wanted the protection of Her Majesty. There were a couple of rebel tribes who said that they were going to invade the Auckland region and kill everybody and put the babies on pikes and all of that kind of stuff, who were resisted by both Māori and British forces. So there's a there's not only a rivalry between tribes, but a rivalry between the British government and certain tribes as well at the same time, as well as the French. You know, it's kind of like a whole mishmash of rivalries all going around. And that's all underpinned by the fact that there were civilizations here before Māori even got here. Even elders have spoken of these, what eventually, after many, many, many years, became known as kind of like wood nymphs and fanciful creatures and what have you.
Yeah.
According to some of the... Kaumātua, who are, you know, Māori elders, they said that these were actually real people back in the day, and they had red hair, pale skin, and they had an extraordinary knowledge of cartography. They knew the stars. They worshipped the elements and the sun. There are artifacts all over this country that are that are thousands upon thousands of years old. Ancient walls, ancient huts, ancient bullhorns where you would pour water in and you would pray to the sun. There are these the Māori call them the surveyors, right? Mm-hmm. Now, within Māoridom, the surveyors is a very closely kept secret. They uncovered a raft of coffins buried high in the hills in the South Island once, and none of the skeletons in those coffins, just bear in mind, Māoris didn't bury themselves in coffins at all. The Europeans did that. And these coffins were thousands of years old, and some local tribesmen within the area were asked by the discoverers, are these your people? And what do we do with their bones and everything? And they go, do what you want. These are not our people. They predate us by thousands of years. You get called racist for just saying this. By just producing archaeological evidence, you get called racist in this country. Okay?
Really?
There's a thing called a treaty industry. And what happened is, in the Treaty of Waitangi, it was basically a scam, okay? The Māori were really difficult to defeat in battle. They invented trench warfare. They invented guerrilla warfare. They're unbelievable, really, just in terms of military tactics. They were the most dangerous people on earth at the time. And even today, the Māori battalion in World War II is one of the most infamous battalions of that generation as well. Wow. They were the only, they were one of only two battalions, I think, in the world that the Germans were known to fear. And this is the thing. You have a warrior spirit, okay? That warrior spirit needs to be cleansed as far as the establishment is concerned, so that you can prevent any kind of uprising, any kind of resistance. And I spoke with Tamaiti, who's a chief Māori activist. Like, he's just, if you want to talk about a Māori activist in terms of, I'm an activist because I'm Māori,
He's the man, and he's a really nice guy. Like, he's actually quite lovely, and he's fully tattooed up. He looks really intimidating, but he's just got, you know, a bit of a belly, and he's just in his garage, you know, painting stuff with his little grandkids and everything like that. And then they bust him for running this training camp where he's teaching people how to use automatic weapons, teaching them how to make Molotov cocktails and stuff like that, because he knew about the New World Order. So naturally, the government surveils his entire town of 2,000 people. He spends millions of dollars and then raids the town. Okay, and they point guns. They point guns at women, children, old ladies, and then call them the terrorists.
Well, that's a tactic which we've seen everywhere. That is absolutely fascinating information. Now, we are coming up to the last couple of minutes of the show. Vinny, would you like to tell people where they can find you? I mean, are you basically findable through your own website?
If you search Vinny Eastwood, Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. You will be able to find me. It's quite easy. VinnyEastwoodShow.com. Also have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/Mr News, Guerrilla Media. And if you want to have any further look into some of these things that I've been talking about, you can basically search names or topics on my YouTube channel or on Google plus my name. And the chances are fairly good that you'll find something on what you're talking about. So if you want to talk about ancient New Zealand censored history, the guy I'd be looking for is Martin Doutre, D-O-U-T-R-E. He's a really cool, cool guy there, Martin.
Well, Vinny, what I would like, I mean, I am absolutely fascinated by these ancient artifacts in Australia and New Zealand. And maybe we can do a show again in the future and have one of these guys on as a joint guest between us.
I don't see why not.
Okay, now, Vinny, thank you very much. It's been a great show, and we'll definitely invite you back.
All right, thanks.
Take care, everyone. See you next week.